Robinson.
May it please the court, my name is Rachel Funes, attorney regulation number 41716, and I represent Mr. Williamson. Several months ago, I got an envelope in the mail from the Colorado Denver Police Department. And it looked really important, so I didn't put it in the junk mail, I opened it right away. And it was a letter notifying me that a sexually violent predator had recently moved into my neighborhood. It was inviting me to a meeting to find out more information about this person. So I couldn't go to the meeting, so I sent my husband. And he came back with a piece of paper that had my neighbor's picture on the corner, and then it had information about his name, his date of birth, his address, identifying features like scars and tattoos, his crimes of conviction, the kind of car he drives. More recently, I received a similar notification in the mail that actually had the offender's information right there in the letter. Applying the factors of Smith v. Doe to Colorado's SVP notification requirements, it becomes clear that a departure from the current case law is warranted. Here, 7 out of 9 of the factors weigh in favor of finding that the SVP designation is a form of punishment. Perhaps the most distinguishing factor of our SVP notification system is that here, unlike in Doe, our system is similar to the traditional shaming punishments. It is not a passive notification system where information is made available on the internet and people can go onto the internet and find it, as in Doe. Instead, here, we actively disseminate this information to our communities, and in particular to the SVP's neighborhood and beyond, if law enforcement at its discretion decides that that's necessary.
Ms. Funes, let me ask you one question. We've got the Allen case from our Supreme Court, which says that SVP is not punishment. So is this case distinguishable, or is this court bound to follow Allen?
I believe that that particular statement in Allen is dicta, which is not controlling on this court. It wasn't a necessary issue for the Allen court to decide. It was peripheral to the issue in Allen. In the dissent in Allen, Justice Coates actually talks about some factors, the fact that issue was not raised in the case by the parties in that case, and talks about some factors that might indicate that it was punishment if the issue had been addressed by the court. So my argument is that it's not controlling because it's dicta in that case. However, even if and the SVP designation is not punishment, there are still some basic due process requirements that the court must meet before it can find that an offender is a sexually violent predator. The state has to establish any fact that supports the SVP finding by preponderance of the evidence, and the SVP finding cannot be based on misinformation of a constitutional magnitude. Here, earlier in the same proceeding, the district court found that Mr. Williamson's prior felony sex conviction was constitutionally invalid due to the ineffective assistance of counsel. This means that the state failed to prove by preponderance of the evidence that the prior conviction was constitutionally valid. The court would not have been able to make that finding under the habitual criminal case law if the state had been able to prove by a preponderance of the evidence that the conviction was valid.
What is the significance, if any, of the fact that in his motion to attack that conviction, he did not ask for it that the attack to apply to the sexual violent predator designation, but only to the habitual criminal?
Well, my argument is that this is akin to a sufficiency determination, because without the prior felony conviction, there was not sufficient evidence to determine that he was a sexually violent predator.
I know, but he didn't ask that it not be used for that purpose.
Correct.
He asked for it only not to be used with respect to habitual criminals.
Right.
Does that limit the order given by the court, limit suppressing that conviction?
I don't think so. I think that at most, it makes it an issue of plain error. I don't think it is plain error because I think it's a sufficiency challenge, but if it is under plain error, I think that it is a plain error in this case because the error was obvious. The court had already found in the same proceeding that the prior conviction was constitutionally invalid. The case law is well established that you cannot use information of a constitutional magnitude, misinformation of a constitutional magnitude in sentencing a defendant. And here, it was something that affected the outcome of the determination because the prior conviction was necessary to the SVP determination.
Ms. Funes,
Can I ask you about why you think it was misinformation? My understanding was the court's order suppressed the use of the conviction for purposes of habitual criminal proceedings. The court did not vacate that conviction. So at the time of the SVP proceedings, the defendant remained convicted of that offense, which is exactly the finding that's necessary for the SVP determination. So that was not a mistake. It wasn't misinformation. It was correct information.
Well, I think it's akin to the U.S. Supreme Court case that I cited in the opening brief, Tucker, United States versus Tucker.
Mm-hmm.
Because in that case, that was a discretionary sentencing case. So the court relied on prior convictions in that case in giving the defendant the maximum sentence. And then the convictions were later determined to be invalid because the defendant did not have the assistance of counsel. And the United States Supreme Court held that that sentence was based on misinformation of a constitutional magnitude. And in that case, at the time of the sentencing, those sentences were actually still valid and were actually on the defendant's record. However, they were later determined to be invalid. And the U.S. Supreme Court case in Tucker basically works on the assumption that if they were once determined to be invalid, they've always been invalid, and therefore the fact that the court relied on them thinking that they were valid was misinformation of a constitutional magnitude. And I think that's the same thing that we have here. You have a conviction that hasn't been vacated, but it has been found to be constitutionally invalid, and therefore the court should not be able to rely on that.
Have you found any cases in which a court has suppressed a conviction, suppressed it, not vacated it, but suppressed it for use for one particular purpose in a proceeding, but not for another?
I have not found any cases like that. There are a lot of cases in the habitual criminal context where they say that if it's suppressed for that purpose, it's only for that particular proceeding. However, this SVP determination was made in the same proceeding under which the conviction was suppressed for habitual purposes.
Did the trial court here have jurisdiction to vacate the conviction?
Could you explain the question a little bit more?
Well, normally when you a proceeding to vacate a conviction is a Rule 35 proceeding,
mm-hmm.
which occurs in the same trial court or same district that the conviction occurred in. And I think one of the purposes of that requirement is that maybe it will be heard by someone familiar with the proceedings. But be that as it may, does the subsequent criminal court have the jurisdiction to vacate a conviction entered by another court?
I think that the court does have jurisdiction to determine whether whether the court did have jurisdiction to determine whether the sentence was valid for purposes of the habitual criminal proceeding. There's a lot of case law on that. And so I think once the court made that determination, it was duty bound by due process not to also rely on that conviction for other sentencing purposes. Just because the fact that the district court in this case, I'm not even sure if it was the same district court that handled the trial. But I mean, the case law is really clear that the district court had the right to look at the conviction for purposes of the habitual criminal proceedings and determine whether it could be used to enhance his punishment in that way. And I know the state has argued that the court shouldn't have determined it because it was out of time. I disagree with that. I think that the court was within its right to rely on,
Well, to refresh your memory, I think this case comes out of the Arapahoe County District Court, and the prior case was in Denver.
Oh, the 2003 case was in Denver?
Yes.
Okay, I apologize. I didn't realize that. Well, yeah, I do think it's still under people be well, you're in a long line of cases. It's still within the court's right and also the court's duty to determine whether prior convictions are valid before relying on them for habitual criminal purposes when that's been raised in the case. And that's what the court in this case did. It found that the defendant had excusable neglect for raising this issue at a time, and it found that the prior conviction was invalid.
Ms. Venice, what if we disagree with the trial court's finding about justifiable excuse?
Well, I think that that's a factual determination that is usually left to the discretion of the trial court. So I think in this case, if you think the court didn't make sufficient findings, perhaps the appropriate remedy would be a remand. But I do think that the court was allowed to rely on present need as a factor. And that's a factor that's listed in People v. Weidemer, which is a Colorado Supreme Court case from 1993.
Okay. Can I ask you a separate question? You earlier said that the habitual criminal proceeding was the same proceeding as the SVP proceeding, I think. Or are they all the same proceeding?
Mm-hmm.
I'm confused by that because obviously different facts and different legal questions are at issue, different burdens of proof apply. Why are they the same proceeding?
Well, it's the same. The defendant was charged with the crime, including the habitual criminal counts.
Right, and but the SVP designation is not part of the allegations in the criminal information or an issue at trial.
It was an issue at sentencing in that same proceeding, though, once the defendant pled guilty to one of the crimes. And actually, I disagree that the burden of proof is different. The burden of proof for the habitual criminal proceeding in terms of invalidating the conviction was whether there was evidence by preponderance that it was a valid conviction, and that's the same standard for determining whether a fact has been proven for SVP purposes.
Okay, let me ask you a related question. Earlier, there was a question about whether you've ever seen a court suppress a conviction for one purpose but then use that same conviction for another purpose.
Mm-hmm.
But doesn't that happen all the time? Like, at trial, a court might suppress evidence of a prior conviction under 404B. But that same conviction can be used at sentencing to aggravate or enhance the defendant's sentence.
I'd have to think about that for a little bit. But I think the 404B context, it's a little bit different because there's a test for why that's not allowed, and it's for evidentiary reasons why it's not allowed so that it doesn't prejudice the jury. And in this case, the reason that the prior conviction was not allowed for habitual purposes is the same reason it shouldn't be allowed for SVP purposes. I'd like to reserve the remaining time.
Sure.
Okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, may it please the court. My name is Kathy Gillespie and I'm representing the people of the state of Colorado today. My registration number is 26109. I'm going to focus on the last issue about the scope of the motion to suppress and whether or not that could be used in the SVP determination. In answer to your question, Judge Roy, this court could not vacate the conviction of the Denver County case. And I think the Wright case that I cited in my brief talks about the fact that the ruling in a motion to suppress an habitual criminal proceeding doesn't even bind the court if that same defendant goes back and challenges it on 35C on the same grounds. I also disagree that it's a question of the sufficiency of the evidence. I think really the question is what was the scope of the suppression order of the prior conviction, and I think that's a question I wasn't able to find any cases directly on point in Colorado. Since it wasn't raised below, I think it clearly is plain error. So the scope of the suppression, if we start with what the motion requested and what the trial court ruled, the motion specifically said when the defense filed their motion to suppress that they were not asking that the conviction be vacated or invalidated in any way. They were asking for it to be suppressed solely for habitual criminal purposes. And as a result, the trial court issued its order with that same limitation. And as Judge Roy, you pointed out, he remained convicted. That was a valid conviction that remained on his record after the conclusion of that motion to suppress. When you look at the various Colorado Supreme Court case law, Marquez, Quintana, Lacey, that all talk about the purpose behind the motion to suppress an habitual criminal proceeding, it says that it bars the use of the invalid conviction in the proceeding where it's challenged, when it is used to increase punishment or support guilt. And that's why in my answer brief, I talked about whether or not a SVP finding increases the sentencing range or increases punishment. I think the various divisions of this court are overwhelmingly in agreement that it's not punishment. And then I think.
It's very difficult to tell the difference between it and punishment.
The, you mean the SVP finding? Sorry.
Would you agree to that?
I would agree to that. So the SVP designation, when the courts go through the Mendoza factors and talk about community notification and registration, all of the divisions of this court have been unanimous in finding that it doesn't meet those factors and it should be considered.
But we also incarcerate, it's to protect the public, I understand that. But we also incarcerate people, quote, to protect the public.
Correct. And I think.
That's why I say it's very difficult to tell the difference.
Sometimes it is. I think, however, when you are punishing someone and you're incarcerating them for punishment, it's directly related to the number of years that they're given. And in this case, it's simply a designation that's going to dictate registration requirements and community notification requirements.
For the rest of your life.
For the rest of your life. That's correct. But it does not increase the defendant's time in confinement. It doesn't impose fines, costs, things of that nature.
Ms. Gillespie, I know in the opening brief, your opposing counsel mentioned that it may affect parole eligibility. And this may be distinguishable from the Roland case where it was speculative whether it affected parole eligibility, but I don't think in this particular case it was speculative. There was I think the Sex Offender Management Board is required to object to a release onto parole if there is an SVP finding.
Only if it's a determinate prison sentence. Mm-hmm. So if the convictions of the defendant fall under the indeterminate sentencing guidelines, then that's not.
Right, and my understanding here is it was a 6-year determinate term. It wasn't under the indeterminate sentencing scheme.
It was under the indeterminate, but I think because it was a class 5. In other words, he was eligible under SOLSA because it took place after November 1st of 98. Mm-hmm. But I think because of what the plea bargain plug him down to, I would agree that he was not given the indeterminate sentence under those guidelines.
Okay, so given that he was given the determinate 6 years and I think maybe 2 years mandatory parole, then is there a distinction between this case and Roland on that factor of whether it does affect parole eligibility? Does that make a difference?
There's not in this case because my reading of the handbook is that they are, the SOMB requires them to object to discretionary parole under the determinate sentence, okay, not a mandatory parole sentence.
And Ms. Gillespie, what's the effect of the SOMB's objection? Does that mean the defendant cannot be paroled under a discretionary system?
I don't think under the discretionary system. I think that's the SOMB's position that they take. Right.
So it's not binding on the parole board?
No, it's not binding on the parole board. The parole board's given its factors that it has to look at, how far they've progressed in treatment, things of that nature, and then they make their determination. The SOMB, just like a party to the parole hearing, can make its recommendations, and then the parole board makes its decision, taking all of that into consideration.
Okay, thank you.
I think the difference in the cases that my opponent cites, Tucker, Padilla, which is a Colorado case that talks about, and this was in the discretionary sentencing portion or context, was that in Tucker, the prior convictions were found to be constitutionally invalid because of a denial of the right to counsel. And the Padilla case that I cite talks about the fact that in a discretionary sentencing context, the defendant has no right to an evidentiary hearing to challenge the validity of his prior convictions. The Padilla court talks about, I think it's Custis is how you pronounce it, C-U-S-T-I-S, and talks about the only place that the U.S. Supreme Court has made an exception in that context is if there is a denial of the right to counsel. And their justification for that in a very short sentence was basically that type of a denial of the complete right to counsel would affect the fundamental fairness of that valid conviction and would so be
it would require it be reversed, right? Structural error?
It would, depending on where the denial of right to counsel. There are some cases that talk about if it's in the sentencing context, it doesn't affect the conviction. But I would agree with you, and I think what I would point out here is the validity of those prior convictions were challenged for ineffective assistance of counsel and whether or not he was given appropriate advisement of the charges and the elements and the sentences that he was facing.
You're talking about in this case?
In this case, yes, sir. I would also point out that the rule does allow for this court, even though the trial court, who I think was clearly in error, finding that this present need had arisen 4 years after the time bar had passed, and decide the trial court, for whatever reason, decided to hear the motion to suppress on the.
Ms. Gillespie, before I go on, what if we disagree with the trial court's finding on justifiable excuse? What then? Does that have any effect on our analysis?
It does, because it gets rid of the question altogether. If the trial court's ruling on the validity of that prior conviction in the habitual criminal proceeding shouldn't have even been heard, then now we have a conviction that remains on the books, and this court has negated their finding that that prior conviction was invalid.
Do you think that issue is before us properly, whether or not the court correctly found justifiable excuse?
I don't think it was, you know, that it is in the context of the scope of this suppression motion, asking to invalidate that. And the way I looked at it was, it's a factor for this court to consider in why it's important for an invalidation of a prior conviction to go back to the trial court. You know, in this case, because this issue was never raised in any way in the trial court, you know, whether or not the DA wanted to challenge the court's finding of justifiable excusable neglect on M21 or at that point, didn't really come into play, because after the court made its habitual findings, there was a plea entered and the case was pled out, and so there was no real reason to keep going and to challenge necessarily the trial court's ruling on that. And even at the time of the SVP hearing, nobody brought it to the trial court's attention from the defense that he shouldn't be considering this prior conviction. So again, there's no reason for the prosecutor to go back and re-argue something that really was a moot point at that point.
Ms. Gillespie, can you clarify then for me, because I understand there is the time bar when there's a 35C proceeding to vacate a conviction. So does that time bar apply equally in habitual when the request is merely to suppress the use of the prior in the habitual proceeding?
Absolutely. Okay. By the plain language of 16.5.402, it says that statute of limitations applies equally to a 35C and a motion to suppress. And for obvious reasons, then you're not litigating cases like this 4 years after that deadline passed. So I think even though we don't have cases directly on point, I think if the court looks at the case law that talks about the parameters of the motion to suppress prior convictions in a habitual criminal proceeding, this wasn't used to increase punishment or support guilt. There is a rational reason why in a habitual criminal phase, defendants are given the right to rebut that presumption that the prior conviction is valid. They're getting an automatic sentence enhancement and a very significant one. But I think the fact that divisions of this court and our Supreme Court has made a distinction between discretionary sentencing, that the court doesn't even have to look necessarily and have an evidentiary hearing on the validity of a prior conviction. When Padilla goes through that analysis, it talks about some things that are applicable in this case too. The prior conviction for this defendant was one of four factors. He had to meet the age requirement, he had to meet the type, the crime that he was convicted of, and then you had to meet the relationship prong and then the risk prong as well.
Ms. Gillespie, sorry to interrupt you. How do you respond to the defendant's point that the habitual criminal proceedings are in fact the same as the SVP proceedings? That this is all one proceeding?
I disagree. I think that there are, the habitual criminal proceeding itself is a bifurcated trial from even the underlying guilt phase of the trial. And I think that here the court was working with a particular burden of proof, who had that burden of proof differed, taking evidence and considering in the context of the people are trying to use this prior conviction to now triple or quadruple the prison sentence that this defendant is facing is a very different analysis and proceeding than the SVP designation, which isn't even part of the defendant's sentence. It's a finding that the trial court makes after the fact. I disagree. I think Allen very clearly in the Supreme Court says that the SVP designation is not punishment, and I think that is binding on this court. I think that that finding was critical to the Supreme Court's finding in Allen and all those cases that came out at the same time, talking about the scope of that SVP hearing, what evidence the trial court needed to consider, whether it's something that could be passed off to the Sex Offender Management Board and coming up with a criteria, or it had to stay with the trial court. So while not the specific issue raised, I think that finding from the court, which was unequivocal, and while clearly Justice Coates would like that to come up a different way in front of the court, he was the only justice out of the bench that felt that way.
Well, didn't Justice Marcus also note that that issue wasn't squarely presented, so she didn't express any opinion about whether it was punishment or not?
Correct. But she didn't go the next step, as Justice Coates giving us a little preview as to which way he might go, should the issue
to
come
draw
up.
The roadmap.
After saying he wasn't going to draw it. But so I think clearly it's an issue. It's a question of law, the scope of that suppression motion. It's a plain error standard of review. The fact that there was no case law out there to guide the trial court to bring it to its attention. The fact that the motion to suppress clearly said for habitual purposes only. The trial court's ruling was limited to that effect. I just don't see how the defense gets to this kind of global finding that once it's been invalidated, it's invalidated for any kind of purpose. And I think the cases that deal with kind of tangential issues, that Bright and Padilla, I think lay out some of the reasons that justify not making that finding in this case.
Well, let me ask you a question, just approaching it at a different angle, is we have the court saying it was constitutionally infirm, the 2003 conviction. So once the court made the finding that it's constitutionally infirm, can the court rely on that for the SVP designation?
I think it can, and I think that's where Padilla is instructive on that, that you know, courts don't. While we had a specific finding here, Padilla, the court is saying things that, you know, that's not the validity of that conviction unless you're going to use it to increase punishment or change the sentencing range. It's a different proceeding. It's a different question of law that the trial court's having to answer. It's different burdens of proof. And so I don't think in this case, I think a court could find under that burden of proof and for what that was, what the trial court was being asked to look at, that question could be very different from his opinion to use it in something like a SVP designation. And the reality is, to give finality to those judgments, that conviction is valid and it remained on the books. And that's all that's required from the Sex Offender Management Board on that risk assessment. The court doesn't have any other questions.
Here's not. Thank you, Ms. Gillespie. Ms. Funes, you have 2 minutes and 54 seconds.
I just wanted to start out by saying that Padilla is distinguishable because in that case, the holding was that the court is entitled to presume that prior convictions are valid for purposes of sentencing. And in that case, there had been no previous finding that those convictions were invalid. Whereas here, there is no longer a presumption that this conviction is valid because this very court in this proceeding has determined it wasn't valid. I also wanted to point out that under TUFO, whether or not this is punishment is not a necessary finding for issue one in the opening brief. In TUFO, that's one of the Court of Appeals decisions that actually finds that the SVP decision is not punishment. And yet they go on to say these things about it has to be found out by a preponderance of the evidence, has to be reliable under due process, and it can't be misinformation of a constitutional magnitude. So that's true.
And it's been as TUFO and seems to assume that the SVP designation is part of the sentencing, which therefore means it's a punishment.
I think that, I mean, TUFO is decided prior to Allen, so I think that it's possible that they viewed it as part of the sentencing. However, I think that the decision in TUFO understood, or I disagree with this, but the decision in TUFO, the panel in that court, in that case, felt that it wasn't punishment, and yet they went on to determine that it had to have these due process protections, that it had to be reliable, and that it had to be based on the lack of information.
But the only case it cited for that was Tucker, which had to do with increasing punishment.
Correct. Tucker did have to do with increasing punishment. And, you know, if this court finds that it is required that it increase punishment, then I would just go back to issue number three, which is that, in my opinion, the SVP designation here in Colorado is distinguishable from those passive registration requirements and does constitute punishment. If you look at all of the 9 factors and apply all of those to this case, it's distinguishable from the other cases.
Was there an evidentiary hearing held with respect to the motion to suppress prior conviction? Did the court take any evidence?
I don't believe so. I would have to go back and look at the record, but my recollection is that it was all based on briefs that were filed, like pretrial suppression motions, and I don't remember there being an actual hearing on it.
What was the basis for it?
The court found the conviction invalid based on ineffective assistance of counsel.
Without the testimony of counsel?
I think it was based on the pre-plea advisement, which was in the record. He said it was confused, contradictory, and inaccurate. The documents that explained the elements were not attached. The attorney failed to specify the sentencing range for the charge, and the defendant was never advised at the hearing of the sentencing range or the long-term consequences of the plea. So there were several factors that I believe were evident on the record that the court found made the plea invalid.
Thank you, counsel, for your argument.
Thank you
to both counsel for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.